Good afternoon. This is Dr. Dan Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry in the Inland Pacific Northwest of the USA. Today is actually the 3rd of July, continuing on our process of celebrating our independence from a European tyranny. So I'm going to continue on with this membrane biochemistry and dealing a lot with the immune system because I have to finish off the papers I've been describing. Now, you know, right off, when you think about a process that involves a specific induction due to a surveillance detection response looking for potential dangerous substances or microorganisms, including pathogenic microorganisms that are in the human system, is going to be the kind of mechanism that is the inflammatory mechanism that could be potentially very dangerous. Dangerous because if it's sustained, it can cause a great deal of tissue damage because inflammation involves killing cells. What cells? Cells that are infected. As well as, of course, if there are bacterial cells or there are zoospores or there are some other kind of reproductive phase of, say, a parasite, or a fungi in the system, it's going to try to kill those cells as well. It's also going to try to kill any virus-infected cell, right? And it's going to be running off of the PAMPs and off the toll-like receptors, okay? So when that happens, when inflammation is no longer under control, you can then get a secondary, very high morbidity, chronic pathophysiology, and that is an autoimmune response. That's when the immune cells that have been triggered to deal with an authentic pathogen or an authentic disease cell start reading into the healthy cells, finding similar antigenic epitopes on the surface of those cells as presented via an MHC, that is an HLA, and then ultimately that can induce an autoimmune disease, which can be chronic and not deadly, or can be hyperactivated and can kill a person, okay? So that means that inflammation has to be tightly regulated. So that's the point. It's regulated because there are multiple ligands and multiple receptors, and then all downstream from that are signal transduction cascades, which are ultimately going to yield in the infected cell or in the immune cell transcription factors, which are going to then elicit the transcription of specific genes that are either going to slow down the inflammation process or ramp it up, depending on the flavor of the signaling to them, coming from adjacent cells and from circulation. Okay. So it's a very involved system and very complicated. Now, when you're taking that and putting it into cell culture and you're inducing a specific, say, macrophage lineage like we were doing in this paper, and you're using lipopolysaccharide from bacterial cell wall, that's a very artificial means to generate an immune response. It's not an immune response at all. You're just looking at how macrophages are working in culture. So I want you to always keep that in mind. When I tell you we use cell culture, and then we go to a mouse model or sometimes a rat model or some other mammal, and then from there, if we're doing something pharmacotherapeutic or we're actually just trying to discover what are the signatures of a disease, and we start going into phase 1, phase 2, phase 3 trials, getting cohorts of people who have the disease and looking at the course of the disease, and then looking at what pharmacotherapy is available or what surgery is available or nutritional amelioration is available, and following a course of looking at biomarkers, but also pathobiochemical systems within that disease state. Okay. So this artificial system, when you have an LPS-induced inflammation, we know specifically that LPS will turn on toll-like receptor 4. Remember, there are 9 different toll-like receptors, and then there are subspecies of those, at least 9. Now, the signaling cascade downstream of TLR4 is going to be very similar to many other signaling transduction cascades you've heard me talk about. They're going to be kinase cascades, right? And you're going to have a phosphorylation pattern, and then you're going to ultimately get perhaps the transport of phosphorylated proteins, which will either trigger or will be themselves transcription factors. And then those transcription factors are going to bind to DNA, and they're going to do some chromatin retailoring, maybe with epigenetic phenomenon occurring as well to leave a mark there. Remember, that's what epigenetics does. It leaves a mark where it's been. It's like a mark on a page when you go back and read a book and you forgot what page you're on. It's done that way in case you encounter the same pathogen again. So epigenetics, as I keep on saying, is not some kind of rare phenomenon or some great romantic idea that you have this signature in your genome that goes back multiple generations. That also I'm not ruling out, okay? And in fact, there are some studies that were done after World War II with starving people in the Netherlands, and then those people became very obese, and then their children also had weight issues. That could have been an epigenetic phenomenon. I talked about that. I know I didn't give it enough mileage right now, but I think you get what I'm saying, right? Well, epigenetics really is a way to constantly inform the genome as to what's going on with an individual's system. That's why an epigenetic signature is absolutely associated with one human being and not another, right? And it can have massive effects. It can have twins, one twin die from a disease or a subsequent infection, and another twin not, right, with identical genome. So epigenetics is extremely powerful when you think about pathophysiology, pathobiochemistry, and disease states, okay? So again, very, very simplified when you're looking at LPS induction of TLR4 causing a kinase cascade, causing nuclear translocation of transcription factors, which turn on then, yeah, pro-inflammatory cytokines like NF-kappa-B, and then also proteins that regulate the synthesis of the inflammasome, and also ultimately cell fate. And these would be things like ERK kinase and the MAP kinase. So in this paper, they pretreated the LPS stimulated macrophages with DHA, but not EPA or alpha linolenic acid. And they saw a decrease actually in the TLR4 transcript, but no changes were found in the expression of the transcription factors that are subsequent or downstream from TLR4 signaling. Okay. So even though they lost TLR4 transcript, obviously there was enough polypeptide, that is toll-like receptor protein, that you didn't have any effect on the signaling. Now, again, this is cell culture, so it's not an authentic measure of what's going on in vivo, right? But when you pretreat raw macrophages with EPA or DHA, you don't get any real effect on cervix expression. So it's not a translocation phenomenon, it's not in this paper, of multiple toll-like receptors. And also another protein you find on the surface, which is involved in signaling in the immune response, in the immune science, that's CD14. Now, you do get an increased localization of TLR4 and CD14 when you have EPA or DHA treatment in the macrophage membrane lipid raft. And this is the whole point I'm trying to tell you. The lipid raft is a modulatory system to regulate what's going on in the membrane in terms of its fluid dynamics, its topodynamics, that is how it's dealing with the environment biophysically. But also, it is retailoring the repertoire of polypeptides within that membrane. Because the lipid raft isn't just lipid, it's trucking in and trucking out proteins. And those proteins are going to be receptors or co-adapters for receptors or portions of voltage-gated channels or water channels, you see, or calcium-mediated uptake or any of these other potential protein components within a membrane that's going to tremendously alter the fate of that cell and also how that cell signals out. So decreased LPS-induced phosphorylation, nuclear translocation, and indeed the transcription of NF-kappa B when you pre-treat with the omega-3 fatty acids has already been demonstrated to affect macrophages. And the way that this whole paper that I'm talking about got started was, gee, when you take cells and you pre-treat them with massive doses of the very long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids, not the true precursor, the essential, not just alpha-linolenic acid, but we're giving heavy doses of these preformed eicosapentaenoic and docosahexaenoic acid, that you get a downward activity of the M1 phase of macrophage pro-inflammation, okay? And you actually get a triggering of the M2, which is anti-inflammatory, because IL-10 production, amongst other things. So it's the cleanup crew. M2 is the cleanup crew after infection to slow down the inflammatory response, actually, by getting rid of the inflammatory leftovers, that is, cellular debris and also proteins, including pro-inflammatory cytokines. Okay? So the argument has always been that these omega-3 fatty acids perhaps decrease the transcription factor NF-kappa B, and that's going to go through the TLR2 pathway, and there's a ligand they use to study that. So decreased activation by omega-3 fatty acid treatment is basically how people have been arguing what's going on with controlling the inflammatory response, all transcriptional. This paper, however, is showing you that transcription may not even be affected as the primary event for you getting a down swing in the pro-inflammatory response, okay? So the anti-inflammatory properties of omega-3 fatty acids on macrophages mainly decrease the secretion of the pro-inflammatory cytokines, which have all of the ill repute, TNF-alpha, IL-1-beta, and of course, interleukin-6. Interleukin-6 is a very, very multi-purpose pro-inflammatory cytokine, because it also has the growth regulator, okay? And all of that seems to suggest that these omega-3 fatty acids must be somehow directly affecting that LPS-stimulated macrophage polarization. And because it's not all about transcription, but about secretion, what does it argue for? A membrane phenomenon that is downstream from gene expression, basically, okay? So you can keep that kind of in your mind. That's why I'm going to end this paper. There's more to say about it. And I think it was very well done, this 2019 paper. But I want to move on because I want to really get a little bit more involved here now. Paper I found, which was really, really, really fundamental, is in a journal that you normally wouldn't think of as a good biochemistry journal. It's a Journal of Nutrition. And this paper was published, oh gosh, way back in 2007. You know, way, way long time ago. I'm joking, of course. Only, what, 15 years ago. It doesn't matter how long ago a paper was published, by the way. It's absurd to think that older papers are useless. This is always the kind of thing that I've heard driven into research proposals. Well, we're doing something new, so we're going to only use more current papers to describe, or we're going to, you know, describe our experiments to look at some really novel way of understanding, oh, say, obesity or cardiovascular disease. Well, you know, just because a paper has been published 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, doesn't mean that it's been refuted. Sure, research is always refining our knowledge base, right? But the epistemological depth of the primary peer-reviewed published literature cannot be underrated at any level. I found golden nuggets of papers published 10, 15, 20 years ago that were never described as seminal for a whole new branch of research. Yet when you read them, you see how significant they were. But what it tells you also is that many people are smart and they come up with ideas on their own, or they may read a paper and forget about it, and then they have an idea a year later, right? So it's difficult sometimes to ferret out those different occasions of the central nervous system and how those particular synapses are really functioning. And I'll leave that to you to ponder. with your prefrontal cortex. Now, this paper tells me what we already know. The plasma membrane has specific domains. So do all the membranes, by the way. And these membrane domains can have various levels of polyunsaturated, monounsaturated, and indeed saturated fatty acids. And that some of these domains can lift out and lift and come in, right, trafficking in and out, as membrane lipid rafts. Now, typically, I told you, and I'm not changing my tune here, membrane lipid rafts have cholesterol and more sphingolipid than glycerol phospholipid. Okay? They tend to be these domains that have that they're quite neutral, quite hydrophobic, actually, as compared to some of the more ionic glycerol phospholipids. Okay? And you know, one of the major sphingolipids is what? That's right, ceramide. Okay. Now, you do get within the membrane raft as a trafficked protein once it have a glycosylphosphatidyl inositol tail. So remember, many proteins are covalently modified by fatty acids or by entire acyl lipid moieties, such as a GPI, glycosylphosphatidyl inositol tail, so that you get this covalent modification which links the protein into the membrane in a specific three-dimensional space and a specific temporal signature. Okay. Now, the temporal part, that fourth dimension, I always add that, although I must admit, you don't find that in the literature unless you go looking for it. And sometimes people do like time inductions, right? And they do a time induction, or they're throwing in something like, say, eicosapentaenoic acid, and they're doing 0 time, 1 minute, 5 minutes, 20 minutes, 1 hour, that kind of thing. And looking at induction of a transcription rate or something coming off a cell lineage in culture. Okay, well, that's one thing. They're just looking at the uptake of the compound, whether or not it induces, and whether or not it's saturable, right? Which means it's going to be something that's protein associated, right? Because it's binding to some sort of receptor or some sort of reaction pocket, right? But what else it tells you is that the time signature of the activation or of the deactivation or of no activity, even after adding what you know is going to be a ligand that will induce, say, the next day in a living system, in a whole organism, that might mean that multiple different events are occurring, not just the one you think is happening. And this is just classical. So one of the things that people have looked at, and this paper looks at, are membrane lipid rafts and the signaling around proteins that are known to be associated with cancer. One of these is the epidermal growth factor receptor, or EGFR. And with EGFR, what's been discovered is that rafts play a very significant role in getting that receptor to its correct location and in association with other signaling molecules. So as it turns out, this paper way back in 2007 reminds us that there are specific molecular species of rafts called, yes, that's right, a bell should be ringing in your head, caveolae. Remember the caveolae? Those docking regions in the membrane, right? Those ones that are what? They're resistant to lipotoxicity because they maintain a high and heavy lipid load. So they don't become corrupted by high levels of free fatty acid, which moves through the caveolae, which tells you the caveolae are really trafficking a lot of lipids in general, right? And as a byproduct of trafficking lipids, you're going to have some free fatty acids, you see? Okay, or maybe just fatty acids esterified to, you know, a sugar, or esterified to a carboxylic acid, right? Which could be potentially lipotoxic. We can discuss that later. So anyways, it looks like rafts are really involved in this mobilization of EGFR. So these caveolae, remember, they're flask-shaped inversions of the membrane, okay? and they have specific proteins. Remember the cavein and the caveolin story I went through just last week? Okay. So what people want to know is, and we covered a paper that talked about the difference between cavein and caveolin and having a functional caveoli, which is basically a transporting junction within a membrane that can then dissociate and become a lipid membrane raft. Okay. And what we found was that these proteins are necessary. However, what we don't know is how the lipids in all the different molecular species of lipids are precisely associated with carrying other cargo. Okay, so we're not talking about the cavein caveolin story, those two polypeptides, which are associated with getting the caveoli organized in the plasma membrane. No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about the proteins that are being trafficked. So it looks like the caveoli, and we can also say the caveoli that become membrane lipid rafts, negatively regulate EGFR tyrosine phosphorylation. And they do it by ligand binding and receptor activation, which actually induces the movement of the EGFR out of the raft. So when you think about signaling through that protein, the epidermal growth factor receptor protein, normally you think about it promoting cell proliferation and actually cell maintenance, or if it's a cancer cell, survival. But it also appears, and this is again what I emphasize again and again on authentic biochemistry, look at something, you always see a dialectic. EGFR activation also induces in some systems programmed cell death, particularly apoptosis. And that has been demonstrated in human breast cancer cells. And so a common human breast cancer cell that was being used in the last decade are known as MDA-MB231s. So a lot of papers were published using those particular human breast cancer cell line. Now, this paper wanted to do a really interesting experiment. They want to know omega-3 fatty acids of the very long chain type, so the VLCPUFAs, how they may affect the composition of the membrane raft. Okay. And they ask the question, when they have an enrichment of polyunsaturated fatty acid, how does it relate to the lipid raft when it's moving within a tumor cell, and then following along this EGFR, which we know can be tumorigenic, but also can induce apoptosis. So it's a really good protein to look at because you have a multiple valence, you have a dialectic, right? And so that's what they did in human breast cancer cells. Now I've got to look at my time here because I think I've been talking a lot. I'm okay, I guess I got six minutes. All right, let's go back. All right. So a couple of things they found. I'm just going to summarize here real quickly, and then I'll go into detail. They found that eicosapentaenoic and docosahexaenoic acids, those are very long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids of the omega-3 series, right? Those positional isomers. They show that both those fatty acids decrease the growth of those human breast cancer cells. They also showed in very specific ways that both of those VLC PUFAs omega-3 alter the fatty acid composition of the lipid raft. And you might guess how they get incorporated. In fact, EPA and DHA alter the phospholipids of the lipid raft. So some of the glycerol lipids you'll find, there is some, but also some of the sphingoid phospholipids. Now, that means that they either are going to be replacing fatty acids in those lipids, or they are going to be associated with bulk mobility of lipids out of the membrane as the raft without cargo. And if they're not cargoing the EGFR, you see, they're altering the signal transduction and could be a target for what? Right, for chemotherapy, right? or immunochemotherapy, depending on which way you're going here. Because the fourth thing they found is that EPA and DHA decreased cholesterol levels in the raft. Now that's very interesting, right? Because you know that membrane lipid rafts need quite a bit of cholesterol. But of course, membrane lipid rafts are found in the plasma membranes, primarily where they're functioning. And what I always tell you about a mammalian plasma membrane, it's about 50 mole percent cholesterol. So that's not surprising, right? If you're altering the membrane lipid raft composition, you are certainly going to be altering the plasma membrane lipid composition. And that means you could either increase or decrease cholesterol. In this case, it looks like it decreases it. So EPA and DHA also, and this is just, you know, music to my ears, increase RAF ceramide levels, but at the same time decrease RAF diacylglycerol levels. Now there's all kinds of cool things to say about that, about diacylglycerol kinases and phosphatidylinositol 3-phosphate kinases and DAG activity and phospholipase C and all this other signal transduction, which is extremely involved in cell stress response. But I just mentioned it, and now we're going to bracket that off because that's not why we're here in this paper. Now, EPA and DHA also, this is, I guess, number six, decrease the EGFR protein level in the lipid raft, and they increase whole cell levels of the phosphorylated version of the epidermal growth factor receptor. So they get it out of the membrane lipid raft, okay? They get the EGFR protein out of the raft, those two very long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids of the omega-3 series. But at the same time, when you do detect EGFR, you know, doing an immunoblot or whatever, whichever way they're doing it here, it's phosphorylated. So that means the signaling is already modified, right? Or it could be co-modified because of the fatty acid. Now, EPA and DHA, the final thing I'll say, increase whole cell levels of another really important signaling kinase. It's the P38 MAP kinase. And that has gotten a tremendous amount of discussion and play in the literature. I've talked about it many, many times. I'm not going to get into the multiple variations of that because, again, when you lay down the dialectic, you're going to find out that sometimes it is growth promotive and sometimes it causes autophagy, and sometimes it's associated with ferritosis, necrotosis, or apoptosis, depending on the cellular milieu, the neighborhood in which it's being altered. Now, in this paper, I only got about a minute here, they hypothesize omega-3 fatty acids alter the properties of the membrane lipid raft. And they're saying maybe that's the mechanism for the growth inhibitory effect on the breast tumor cell. Very, very intelligent hypothesis, right? They also are arguing that the hypothesis may have some standing because they observed a significant enhancement of both EPA and DHA into the rafts of those MDA-MB231 breast cancer cells. And they found that when they treated with various concentrations and ratios of those two very long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids, plus adding linoleic acid, which is an omega-6, right? So let me take a look here. I think I'm going to have to stop because the rest of this is going to be require me to really, really get into a lot of detail about lipid metabolism as I'm telling you their data. So they're not talking lipid metabolism. They're just giving you their data and they're going to discuss it. I'm going to add in all of the lipid metabolism that's in my memory so that I can pull that forward and explain to you how their work can be interpreted given the corpus of literature that's all about these membrane lipid rafts and lipid metabolism, particularly in the pathobiochemical state. Okay, so I'm going to finish here. Probably the last lecture for today. I might do one on Independence Day. I just don't know. But at any rate, this is Authentic Biochemistry coming to you from the beautiful, now partly cloudy after another beautiful storm, Inland Pacific Northwest along the Clearwater River on the 3rd of July, 2022. I am your host, Dr. Dan Guerra, and I'm wishing you a very fond farewell and saying bye for now.